in Boston, we assume this morning, but to tell us about the week that was. Let me welcome Michael Lonergan, who is Ireland's Consul General to Boston, and he's from Limerick, through no fault of his own. Consul Michael Lonergan, you're very welcome.
Adrian, thank you very much for having me.
I suppose as a starting point, the lead up to the marathon, you, the consulate, the Boston Irish community, the double celebration, associated holiday with Boston, Massachusetts, and the marathon. It was not your first, since you have been the Consul General to Boston since when?
Since 2009, so this is my fourth Boston Marathon. And as you know, Adrian, the Boston Marathon always takes place on Patriots Day here in Boston, which is a local holiday, and it commemorates the Battles of Lexington and Concord, the first real battles of the U.S. Revolutionary War. And I suppose for all of us who are from Ireland, some of these struggles against our own ancient neighbours and sometimes foe always strike certain residents among the wider community here. And the marathon itself is such an enormous event. It's the single biggest day of the year in Boston. You have 500,000 people out on the route watching it. You've got 27,000 people taking part. There's a huge festival kind of atmosphere across the city. As you know, Adrian, Boston isn't a particularly big city in many ways.
Yes.
It often describes itself as the smallest big city in the United States. And there's a certain kind of, as the route gets into the center of the city, it's a much narrower roads and so on. So it becomes a more intimate kind of event. We have a strong Irish connection with the marathon. Every year we have over 100 runners taking part. Irish runners have won the marathon in the past. Neil Cusick from Limerick in 1974, and John Tracy was third back in the 80s. So there's a strong Irish connection. Among the people who run the marathon, the Boston Marathon Association, the former president is a doctor from Mayo, Vinnie Coyle. So there's always been a connection between Ireland and the marathon. I've never been consul in the marathon. Traditionally, we would host an event for Irish runners after the event and so on. So we were sort of involved in the build-up to it. We were at the marathon reception on Saturday night, and we were meeting runners who were over from Ireland, and we were aware friends of ours were running in it. And as I say, the build-up to the marathon here is quite considerable, and one that we felt, I've always felt very much part of.
The hackneyed phrase that all politics is local, but I think that it would be fair to say that Bostonians, particularly those who come from the Emerald Isle, are of the impression that God might have created the world, but indeed the Irish created Boston, and I say that tongue-in-cheek, obviously, but it is a very Irish-connected, proud city, and one that historically has indeed a massive Irish connection. I think you'd agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Bostonians do like to describe the city both as the top of the capital of the world, but also more accurately the capital of Irish America. It's certainly the place in the United States still which is the most Irish in the last census. The line is that one in every four people in Massachusetts claims Irish ethnic origin, but it's actually a higher number than that in Boston, because if you take Boston, it's probably closer to 30-35% of people trace at least some roots back to Ireland. And unlike other cities perhaps further west of the United States, Ireland is still relatively close. It's the nearest part of Europe to Boston. There are direct flights every day, twice a day. There are certainly a considerable number of Irish Americans you meet in Boston have all been to Ireland, and some go regularly. So I think the connection between Boston and Ireland, it's a very contemporary one. It's not just the historic and the mass immigration after the famine or the Kennedys or things of that nature. It's also a contemporary resonance, and it helps a lot, of course, nowadays by the strong economic bonds with many big Boston-based companies like Boston Scientific and Covidien and Genzyme and EMC and State Street and Fidelity all having big operations in Ireland. So the relationship very much is one that's ongoing and is as strong today as it ever has been.
Yeah, and of course, the last time we met, Áine Sheridan and I were sharing an honor, which we don't mind bragging about. It was, we were selected as the Irish Cultural Ambassadors in Holyoke, Massachusetts, last year. And we had to, even though we were going to anywhere, we had to, in fact, shake her hand and say thank you for the for okaying the selection process, whatever that was, because it is one in Holyoke, Massachusetts, that that requires Irish government approval. So you will remember that we were like the cocks of the north, sitting there and absorbing the tremendous atmosphere of Holyoke, Massachusetts, which they claim is much more Irish than the rest of Boston, indeed the most Irish place in Massachusetts. You will remember that was a very significant occasion, and indeed this year, Christine Keneally, the famous and world famous historian and authority on the Irish famine, she was honored this year. So again, thank you for giving us the fortune in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
Well, it was a great pleasure, Adrian. And I must say, it was a wonderful event. I was down there again this year. We had a government minister from Ireland visiting. We went down for the event with Christine Keneally. And the other award was given to Doris Collins Goodwin, the very distinguished American historian. And again, Holyoke is a very special place, especially around the time of the year. And they, as you know, claim to have the third largest parade, it's the largest parade in the world after New York and Dublin. And it's a very special place to visit around the time. And I think, as you and Áine discovered, there's a very, very warm, traditional Irish Cead Mhilleá Fáilte down there. For anybody visiting, and particularly around the time of the year, and there's a great community spirit and volunteer spirit, which has sustained this parade now, which I think it's its 62nd year. And so it's a great reflection on the strength of the community down in that part of Western Massachusetts.
Yeah. Obviously, the Irish government's number one priority this year is the gathering in Ireland, where, speaking of Fáilte and outreach, a very special effort by the Irish government, which is a rip-roaring success so far. Of course, under the guidance of Tourism Ireland, the Gathering Ireland, has reached out and is reaching out to the diaspora, the Irish diaspora worldwide, to come and see and celebrate. You know, you mentioned a little earlier there about most people that you would meet with any Irish lineage, any Irish background, either have visited Ireland or are thinking of visiting Ireland, and this, of course, is a great year for such. Figures would show that Boston indeed is measuring up, and that continues. But it is a great year, and a great year for visiting Ireland.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, the gathering is one of these things that really has picked up a huge amount of momentum. You know, I think it's a good example of that old idea about, you know, instead of cursing the darkness, sort of light a candle. You know, I think when things are difficult, you need to think of ideas of how you project yourself, how you sell yourself in the international tourism market. I think the gathering is something that was come up with as a novelty, as an idea that would draw people in. I think it's been hugely successful. I have met so many people here in this part of the world who are getting together with friends, neighbours, colleagues at work, and sports clubs, associations, and organising a trip to Ireland. And in some cases, this is the first time that they have been, or in other cases, they're regular visitors, but they're trying to bring family, friends, neighbours, who may not have been before to Ireland. And it's really captured the imagination. And the other thing as well, which is very important, it's longitude and access. And we're lucky here in Boston, we have direct flights every day to Ireland, Shannon and Dublin, and now Aer Lingus have shared an additional aircraft between ourselves and New York. And I think, again, a lot of people listening to you, Adrian, and based in New York here, we have got a choice of direct flights every day from JFK and from Newark, and I think that makes it a much easier sell here.
Absolutely.
It's more difficult when you go.
Well, Joe Byrne, who heads Tourism Ireland here, is very laudatory, and indeed, next to New York, he points out that there's great reaction again from Boston. But this is all over. This is the United States, and for that matter, all over the world. I think the difference this year is that we're going to see people from other areas that normally we wouldn't run into in Ireland, New Zealand, Australia, you name it. They're all gathering. But anyway, that is going well. Boston generally is going well. What kind of preparations do you make, and how do you acknowledge those who come year after year to Boston for the marathon, and also, of course, bring family members and friends with them? And what does that mean as an event, both for Patriot Day and the marathon in the Boston area?
Well, normally every year we have a reception at the consulate for some of the runners that come over in groups from Ireland. There's a long-standing relationship between the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin and the Boston Marathon. Every year, approximately 10 runners, the best 10 runners from RCSI, 5 men and 5 women, who are the fastest times from the Dublin Marathon, come across and run in Boston. And this has gone on for quite a number of years, going back maybe 20 years or perhaps even more. And we've organized events at the consulate. I think this first started with the well-known Irish-American journalist George Kimball back in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yes.
Since this day. Well, that's part of the events we do to mark this. But also, in the course of some of the events leading up to the marathon, there's an opportunity to meet with some of the Irish runners who are over, and their families and friends and supporters. I think the one thing about a marathon that's very striking, and I think what happened on Monday such an outrageously terrible event, is the sense that marathons are really about family. They're about family rallying around and supporting the person running, and the crowds on the street shouting them on, encouragement, and the sense of elation and jubilation at the end of the marathon with family and friends flocking around to congratulate the person who's run it. And I think that's one of the things about the marathon I've always taken away from it here in Boston, is the extent which it really is a very, very family-focused day. And most of the runners coming from Ireland had some family over with them, supporting them, and whatever. That's what made the scenes, I think, at the end of the marathon with the attack so tragic and so particularly appalling.
Now, the Irish consulate in Boston is located on Boylston Street, which is the same street where the attacks took place on Monday. I know that your attention to the parade, and also your own work and coordination in terms of being in your office, is something that was very different this in your fourth year. How did you know? What was your first reaction? How did you learn that on your very street there was what will be historically only the second terrorist attack on the United States?
Well, the consulate is actually on Copley Square. It's approximately a block and a half from where the marathon actually finishes. So I actually been out at 2 o'clock looking at the marathon finishing, there near the finishing line, and I'd walk back to the office, to the consulate, just to get things ready for the runners who would be coming in afterwards. And I was sitting at my desk when I heard the first explosion, and the building visibly shook, and then about 10, 15 seconds later, the second explosion. And then where I looked out of my office windows was actually just past the end point of the marathon, where the runners were being given water and bananas and such for them, and also being given those warm cloaks to wrap around themselves and so on. And it was obvious very, very quickly that whole area was being cleared and were no longer runners coming through, so you knew the race had been stopped. So it was very obvious almost immediately that something very serious had happened, because you knew they wouldn't stop the marathon unless this was a very significant event. And then very quickly you became aware of police sirens, emergency vehicles rushing to the scene, and we were evacuated from the building within about 40 minutes of the explosions going off, and we haven't been able to get back into the consulate since. So we quickly relocated to a nearby hotel, the Back Bay Hotel, which was formerly, up until a couple of months ago, owned by Jury's, and it was very much the Irish headquarters in the centre of Boston, I guess, like St. Patrick's, and down in New York, and also where most of the Irish runners that we were aware of were staying. And thankfully nowadays, with a mobile phone and a laptop, you can have a virtual office almost anywhere, and we very quickly then started about getting into touch with the Irish runners and working through to make sure that all the runners that we knew of were accounted for, and also that their family and friends who were shouting them on from the sidelines, but none of them had been caught up in the blast. And that took a number of hours just to talk it through with people and to make sure that everybody was accounted for, and also to encourage people to phone their families back in Ireland and let them know immediately that they were safe and well.
Now, there were rumours, at least here anyway, that some of the cell phone carriers were in shutdown, that they were specifically ordered to shut down their service. Was there concern there at the hotel and in the immediate area that, whereas obviously the number one priority, as we had here with on 9/11, was to get in touch not only with family members and friends in Ireland, but even locally, that there was, because of the massive volume and in a crisis, in a terrorist situation, even getting through to anybody was difficult at best and impossible for many people. Did you find that in the Boston area too?
Yes, it was very difficult. To be honest with you, I'm still not certain about the city of shutdown. I mean, this was reported at the time, but since then I've heard it being reported that none of the companies were actually asked to shut down. My sense of it was that the system wasn't shut down, in the sense that if you persevered, one call in every five eventually got through, or one call in every six.
Yeah.
And I think the problem really was the volume of usage. You had 500,000 mm-hmm. people on the streets, you had 27,000 runners, and everybody was trying at the same time to ring family and friends to let them know they were safe and well. And I think it was that, rather than a shutdown, that caused difficulties. Because at no point that I can recall was it absolutely impossible either to get or receive a phone call, but that it maybe took four or five attempts to actually get through. And that, of course, made the situation much more difficult. I think it's a little bit like when you're out on New Year's Eve trying to make a phone call at midnight. Sure. It's impossible because the whole world is trying to make a phone call at midnight. And I think it was that just sheer volume of users. I mean, you know, nowadays, of course, I mean, it's just everybody carries a cell phone, and I think everybody in Boston that day there, when the explosion went off, their first thought was to phone their family and loved ones and to say, I'm safe, or ask the question, are you safe? And I think that's what caused the difficulty. But certainly made it a much harder job in those initial couple of hours to make contact and to speak to people and so on.
Now, you know, I think we all know, or perhaps assume, that emergency responders are very much a part of the security that we assume that is provided in the United States. I think, though, that it unfortunately, we wonder and sometimes think that, but what happens in a calamity? What happens in a terrorist attack? Where and how are all of these emergency responders? where's the plan of action? Is there something, you know, that we don't know about? How, for those of us not in, in emergency and in law enforcement and in areas that we obviously rely on, how does all of this come together? What's your own experience with respect to, with the massive number of hundreds of thousands of people in a concentrated area? What was your own immediate reaction to the emergency responders, and how do you think it went?
I think one of the saving graces among all of the carnage and dreadful happenings on Monday was how well the planning in Boston worked. I mean, the fact that the explosion took place right at the end of the Boston Marathon, while it meant that more people were hurt and injured than if it had taken elsewhere on the route, but it also meant they were right beside all the medical facilities that were there waiting to freeze runners coming in at the end of the 26 miles. And so very, very, very quickly, you had doctors, medical personnel on the scene, along with firefighters, police, and then ordinary people. And one of the most extraordinary parts of this whole terrible story is the extraordinary bravery of not just of first responders, but also ordinary people who ran towards the bombs. They took off belts to apply tourniquets to the people's injuries. And there were a number of people whose lives were quite simply saved by the fact that their medical response was so close by. Boston is blessed to have some of the best hospitals in the world, and they were again relatively close by at the scene of the carnage. The emergency plan that the MAUSA had in place worked very, very well. I think in terms just of how well anybody can respond to something as shocking as this, I think the systems that were in place seemed to respond very well and very, very timely. And I think the relatively low death rate is testament to how quickly medical assistance arrived. I mean, there's a certain number of people who were very close to death on arrival at the hospital who were heavily bleeding and severed tumors and so on, who all survived. And I think that's testimony to just the excellence of the medical care, but also how quickly they were able to get from the injuries to the hospital.
And we should acknowledge that in addition to those who were fortunate enough to get away with relatively minor injuries, the part of the carnage unfortunately left some families with amputations, with loss of limbs, with permanent disfiguration, and indeed we cannot underestimate the horror and the tragedy and the lifetime change that this carnage and this terrorist attack has left in its trail.
Oh, I absolutely. I mean, some of the injuries people have suffered are truly, truly horrific. People in some cases using both legs, for example, and some of the injuries to very, very young children losing limbs and so on is really really just heartbreaking to read about. Along with, of course, the three victims on the who died at the scene and the police officer who had been killed since then. It would be very, very difficult. I think one thing though a very proud chapter, I think, of Irish America Adrian, has tended to be the service in the police, in the fire brigade, in the fire service, and in the first responders by people of Irish American heritage, and certainly among the police officers and fire service people and first responders, and among those who were interviewed afterwards, you saw lots and lots of Irish names emerging in that, and it's another, I suppose, sad but proud chapter in that very, very, very strong Irish American tradition of service in the police force, in the fire service, and in the other first responders.
I think that, you know, in emergency and in tragic situations, we read and we hear about human nature, and indeed we hear about those who run for their lives, and most of us, I think, would probably lean towards that kind of reaction. But I think that because of the event itself, because of the Boston Marathon, the focus, the images, the live coverage, and obviously the archival material will show that, yes, and you mentioned it before, but I think it is astonishing to find that that some people do feel, without any training, without any background, without any opportunity to plan, to think about what they might do, but to see the people actually there running to see what they can do, not being blinded by the blood, by the horrific war attack on individuals, that they were there. That's some kind of reaction that I think, again, we won't forget. The covers, the images, the photographs, everything will be part of a long-term memory.
Well, absolutely. And I think you know, that is one of the things that has come out very, very strongly. I was at the interfaith service held at the cathedral in Boston on Thursday, where President Obama spoke very, very movingly, as did the governor and the mayor, and the various religious leaders from the major religions in the area. And that was a constant theme in it about the grace, the generosity, the spirit, the patriotism, the selflessness and humanity shown by so many people in this terrible, terrible tragedy. And that was seen as something that this tragedy, in some respects, as often is the case with these things, it brought out the best in people rather than the worst, and brought out the best in the city. And not just among those, you know, whose profession it is to respond and save lives, but also among ordinary people caught up in this terrible tragedy. And already there are so many stories about the selflessness and bravery, people running towards the bombs rather than running away from them, and so on. And the President, Obama, gave a particularly eloquent, I think, tribute to those people on Thursday at the Cathedral of the Holy Cross here in Boston.
Tell us about the shutdown of Boston yesterday and the emotions that Bostonians and those who live and work in the area. That's obviously a first. We can only imagine what that must have been to people in particular, like yourself, who have a massive responsibility. You don't have an office, you don't have access to your office. You're doing the best you can. I assume you're at home, and you and everybody else in the area was told to stay indoors, stay there. And the image, the massive security forces, the machine guns, all of the security, all of the agencies to freeze a neighborhood must be something which you will remember forever and a day.
Absolutely. I mean, the Watertown is about 4 miles from where I live in Boston. We were one of the neighborhoods that were shut down. Not just the city, but many of the suburbs were also shut down. To see the photographs in today's paper, or to see my media last night of what downtown Boston looked like yesterday, was truly incredible. It literally was a ghost town. I mean, nothing was open. The restaurants, shops, offices, everything closed down. There was no traffic on the streets at all. There was nobody on the streets. At one stage, they suspended the cab service, suspended the public transport. The extent to which people obeyed the instructions or the requests of the governor to stay at home and stay indoors was really quite remarkable. I was in the suburb I live in. Really, you just saw nobody on the streets, nobody out and about. All of the stores were closed. It led to a very eerie fairly odd atmosphere, particularly I would imagine if you're in the center of Boston. But as you know, American cities never really stop. I mean, if you're in Dublin, perhaps on Christmas Day, it's very quiet in the center of the city. But even in American cities, that isn't the case. There's always a bustle and a hustle and people around and crowds any day of the year. And that never really stops. And yet here you had a major American city, literally empty of people. There's obviously been a, which is in the great scheme of things is trivial, but clearly the last week alone, I've heard fantastic sums being guesstimated as to how much this has cost Boston in terms of lost revenue and commercial activity and things of that nature. But the outpouring of relief last night when the second suspect was arrested and the impromptu celebration that took place in the center of Boston, the way people left their homes and came out and sort of marched and celebrated on the streets and they braced police officers and so on. I think it showed the extent to which this event has absolutely taken over Boston over the last week, the sense of which fear and worry has really stalked the streets of Boston, and the enormous sense of I think celebration would be the wrong word, but I think relief is probably the correct word that people felt when the news filtered through at about 8:45 last night that the police had in fact arrested the second suspect.
Let's call it a hairy half-hour period, which must have brought tensions to your immediate area last night when the word was spread by the authorities that somehow the younger terrorist brother, the authorities were saying we've lost his trail. What an amazing reaction that must have had on people who were there. Those who were locked down for the entire day to be told at nightfall, sorry, but we've lost the trail. That has got to be a high point in terms of fear and anguish and of wondering whether or not this would continue and for how long more. That half-hour period, describe that for us.
Yeah, well, I think it was because you were very much aware that the full resources of the state of Massachusetts, the FBI, the state police, the Boston Police Force, the Watertown Police, and other agencies were literally being poured into this 20-block radius. And I think you felt there was a certain inevitability that they would find this guy. And at every press conference that came, you were waiting for the announcement to say, yes, we have arrested him, we have got him. And since this belief, having shut down the whole city for the whole day and poured these resources in, there was a sense of disbelief that he had somehow managed to evade a capture, and a sense of fear, well, if he's not there, then where is he? And I suppose you're doing the math and thinking, well, that's only 4 miles away, could he potentially be somewhere out in this area and next way, and said. And of course, it's interesting that the very second they lifted the curfew, this man walked out to check his backyard, and then he noticed something askew. He'd stayed in his house all day in deference to the police request, and it's only when he walked outside and looked around his backyard and saw something amiss, and then saw the guy in his boat, 9911, that the whole thing started again. As I understand it, the police were perhaps a little unlucky. He was just outside the court they'd established, so I think he was only literally a few blocks further on from where they thought they established the perimeter. And these things, I guess, are always a matter of judgment, and it's difficult to be exact. But I think people here, quite right, they have a lot of faith. I think in the police and federal agencies that I think there was a sense of trust that they would eventually solve this, and I think that trust was repaid. But certainly for that half hour between the lifting of the curfew, as it were, and the reopposing of it. I think people are scratching their heads wondering how this guy could have got through all these various and police and security. And, of course, the thing was, if he hadn't got through, he'd simply hidden somewhere and then was subsequently discovered.
You don't have access, but I assume you will be returning to the Irish consulate in Boston during the week. How did you manage to stay in touch with many? Again, you had the visitors from Ireland, you had the participants, you had the runners, you had a great number of people who came to Boston. You have a massive your constituency, if we may refer to it as such, is huge. How were you able to communicate, and how was your staff at the consulate able to communicate with those who were indeed very, very shook, those who were, part of your responsibility, or indeed most of your responsibility has to do with Irish, Irish-born, with Irish visitors. How did you manage that?
Well, it's obviously difficult when you're outside your own building. We were lucky enough in that through the help of the Boston Police Force, we were able to return to the consulate briefly on Wednesday morning for about 45 minutes, so we were able to pick up things we needed, like blank passport booklets and things of that nature that we just needed in order to issue people needed emergency travel documents to travel back to Ireland and things of that nature. And then we relocated ourselves to our sister agency, the IDA, whose offices were just luckily outside of the crime scene. Ourselves inside Ireland, we were side by side and we were both in the crime scene, but the IDA's offices, luckily enough, were just one block outside of it. So we relocated there and we managed to set ourselves up our computers and we were able to kind of reestablish people know where we were. We were able to issue passports and emergency travel documents to people. We were able to stay in touch with our various parts of our constituents. The Taoiseach spoke with the Governor of Massachusetts on Wednesday. We were able to arrange that to speak to each other. The Taoiseach was keen to speak to pass on condolences of the people of Ireland to the Governor, and particularly as the Taoiseach is planning to travel to Massachusetts next month, and the Governor is due to travel to Ireland next month, so he was very keen, you know, to speak in tribute to the state where there are so many people in Ireland have such strong ties. It was good that was able to happen. The President of Ireland has written to Mayor Menino of Boston as well, in similar vein, expecting his condolences. So the normal work, if you like, Adrian, as far as you could do it, went on. But obviously it is more difficult when you're outside of your own office. But I mean, we have wonderful local staff here in Boston who really went above and beyond to continue to provide a service to our community here in very, very trying circumstances. And again, I think, you know, like all these things, that the whole city is kind of trying to grit its teeth and to do the best it can in trying circumstances. And I think we try to be the same ourselves.
Well, your term of office and your assignment to Boston will definitely be memorable. Word has it that, in fact, you will be moving on, that your assignment is ending, and which happens in the Foreign Service, but I would say that since the first day you arrived in Boston, and through your now 4-year term of office, you'll have much to remember, much to share with your wife Kirsty and your sons, Hugh and Robert. That's it, by the way. You didn't add to that, did you?
No, we have a third son, Gareth. Yes,
there you are now. Well, then I'm glad I met. But to them and to your grandchildren and to family, you will have unique stories, from euphoria to to great tragedy, to being part of that that great Irish American, Irish and Irish American heritage and connection, not only with Ireland and the United States, but Ireland and Boston in particular. You had the it will be a colorful recollection for you, as we wish you and your family, of course, lots of luck as you move onward. You'll have plenty to remember, Consul General of Ireland to Boston, Michael Lonergan, won't you?
I certainly will. I certainly will. It's been a wonderful 4 years. We've enjoyed every second of it. Boston is a great city. It's a great there's a great community here, a great Irish community, a great Irish American community. It underlines to me, it's what I always knew, but it underlines it back home that the single most important relationship we have in the world is that with the United States, and what makes that so important is our community here, our Irish-born community, and our wider Irish American community. And it's been a great honor and privilege to serve the Boston Consul General, and I know we will miss this terribly. And if I'm living in a slight state of denial, Adrian, that August is many, many months away, even though I can see it's coming up now on the horizon, all too close. But I'm sure events like the last week will stay in the memory for a long time, and I think, you know, these will leave a long-standing impression on the city of Boston as well. Both good and bad, the terrible things that were done to Boston, but also the extraordinary acts of selflessness and so on that people did. And I think it's something else I take with me out of Boston, the incredible way that Boston responded to this terrible tragedy, and the part of the Irish people and Irish Americans played in that response. That's something else that my wife and I and our children will be taking back with us back to Ireland when we return in August.
We wish you luck, and we have our problem here in New York, and indeed you're no exception in Boston, is that, of course, if there was a process of election, we wouldn't dream of letting any of the consuls general either here or in Boston go. Yeah, you develop a great closeness and with the people that you are here to shepherd, and through good times and bad. This, unfortunately, was one of the worst periods ever, and the second most horrific terrorist attack in the United States. Let's hope, as we listen to Frank Patterson's version of Let There Be Peace, that from this point forward, not only will we be happy trying to readjust to some level of normality again, but we will remember that we have a lot to be grateful for, and that when the test of time, when tests do come along, to see actually are we in fact going to are we secure, that we will remember with great fondness and great admiration, and that Boston did rise to the occasion for what would be historically remembered as something god-awful. Michael Lonergan, Ireland's Consul General to Boston.
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you, Anya. Good night. Bye. Thank you.
So long. Okay, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Don.
Okay, Don. friends, if you're listening to us in the New York area,